I'm Julia Metzger-Traber.
And I'm Tasha Haverty. Join us in the depths of mothers' hearts, minds, and stories
as we crack open the definitions of motherhood, listen for the unspeakable, and make space for the questions that rise.
What is a mother, we ask?
And everything answers.
Mother is a question. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. During growing demonstrations in Kenya, Parliament was set ablaze.
If people are employed, we wouldn't be here. The reason people are here in big numbers is because there's a problem of unemployment.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today on the show, the latest from Nairobi.
In Israel, a law that exempted ultra-Orthodox Jews from military conscription on religious grounds has been struck down.
If you want to make a claim that is legal or halachic according to Jewish law, you have to back it up with sources, and there are no sources that say that.
Plus, Julian Assange is expected to return to Australia. His supporters there have been vocal and persistent.
Julian Assange is free. Julian Assange is free.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being here. Demonstrations took a violent turn in Nairobi, Kenya today as protesters broke into the parliament and briefly set it on fire. Human rights groups say multiple demonstrators have been shot and killed by police. Dozens more were injured. The protests are in response to new legislation raising taxes in Kenya. They've been fueled by Gen Zers on social media. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi was covering the demonstrations today in Nairobi. She described what the situation was like there.
What I'm seeing in Nairobi right now is really unprecedented, and I've covered several demonstrations over the past 5-6 years. And early this morning, it started very peaceful on the part of demonstrators, holding signs, chanting. But over the course of the day, things really escalated, especially as police threw tear gas into the crowds. Even I inhaled a lot of it. And by the end of the day, there had been live bullets shot at protesters, and several people have reportedly been killed. Now, over the past couple days, officials have been trying to understand who is organizing or sponsoring these demonstrations. But here's what 24-year-old Hugo Lawrence, a college graduate, told me today.
No one is sponsoring us, just our ambition and how we are worrying how tomorrow will be.
The protests in Nairobi and across Kenya, they've been ongoing for over a week. What tipped things into the violence you saw today?
Yes, so exactly. They started last week, and it's been culminating over the past week as things got larger and larger. I mean, what's upset people is the finance bill of 2024. It's a piece of legislation that's being discussed in Parliament. It's an essential piece of legislation needed to create and establish a budget for the financial year. And it comes at a time where the Kenyan government really needs to raise revenue. But what really frustrated Kenyans, what's been controversial about this bill is the proposed taxations that many Kenyans view as punitive. And those taxes range from vegetable oil to sanitary pads to bread. Here today is what 29-year-old Alocho Nyongo said brought her to the streets.
One, I am a woman, so definitely the taxation on pads, I cannot stand for that. Number two, taxation on cancer equipment and treatment. I have lost 4 people to cancer.
Over time, this dissatisfaction and frustration has risen, and it's grown into something that goes bigger than this bill itself. And many Kenyans today were expressing their frustrations with the economy, with corruption, with unemployment. That's something that 25-year-old John Kariuki spoke about frankly today.
The reason people are here in big numbers is because there's a problem of unemployment.
Yeah, well, we can understand how the proposed bill could deeply impact John and Alok further. Halima, I mentioned the Gen Z demographic that seems to be at the center of these protests. What actually makes this a Gen Z protest?
Most of the people I saw today on the street were people in their 20s. And this demonstration, unlike previous demonstrations in Kenya, has been mobilized by ordinary people, many of whom are chatting with each other and organizing using social media platforms like Twitter, like TikTok, especially like Instagram as well. But I will say it has since expanded beyond that to include millennials and people even older than this. I mean, young people are saying this is what they wish their parents' generation would have done, and now they're going to take the lead and being engaged in politics, which oftentimes in Kenya, you see that young Kenyans don't speak up when it comes to elections, when it comes to corruption scandals, but Kenyan youth make up one of the biggest demographics of this country, and yet many of them go to school, they struggle to pay their school fees, and even when they graduate, they don't have jobs to go to, and so this is Kenya's future, they say. They need to be out on the streets and show that they have a stake in it.
What has President William Ruto's response been so far in the face of all this turmoil?
Well, on Sunday, the president did acknowledge the demonstrations. He said he was proud of them, that they were exercising their democratic right, and that he was willing to have dialogue with them.
They have stepped forward peaceful, and I want to tell them, we are going to engage them.
So that's what his outward facing words have been. But on the streets, the police have been behaving in the opposite way, as if Kenyans don't have the right to demonstrate. Human rights organizations have cited multiple abductions of demonstrators. There have also been accusations of police brutality. Some instances have been caught on camera and on video. I asked one young Kenyan today what their response was to the president's call for a dialogue. And they told me if the president wants to talk, he needs to reject this finance bill. Many demonstrators want to see the president and the members of parliament go back to the drawing board.
So a lot of people calling for a full rejection of this bill. Where do it and the violence go at this point, Halima?
Well, Parliament had a session today where they were once again reading the bill, and it was passed in this latest reading with many amendments that did walk back some of the proposed taxations that Kenyans were saying were punitive and too harsh. That said, when that session ended, many members of Parliament reportedly had to flee the building as some demonstrators approached the building in an attempt to occupy it. And there is reportedly a lot of destruction within that building, and there have been videos and pictures showing part of the building on fire. And so that is the situation that's how I left town today. And as I left, I saw hundreds more people and demonstrators coming.
The world's Halima Gikandi there in the Kenyan capital. Late this evening in Nairobi, President William Ruto gave a national television address calling the events at the parliament today treasonous and vowing to stop it from happening again at whatever cost. Ruto repeated his earlier statement that he'll continue to talk with demonstrators exercising their right to protest. The Kenyan military has been deployed to support the police in what officials are calling a security emergency.
Israel's Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that the military must begin drafting ultra-Orthodox Jewish men for compulsory service. The landmark decision effectively puts an end to a long-standing blanket exemption for the ultra-Orthodox. By some estimates, there are up to 63,000 Haredi men who would become eligible for the army. The exemption has led to a deep chasm among Israeli Jews over who should shoulder the burden of protecting the country, especially since the war in Gaza on Hamas began and tensions ratcheted up with Hezbollah in the north. The world's Aaron Schachter has more.
This issue has been a sticking point in Israel almost since the founding of the state in 1948. Most Israeli men are required to serve in the military for 3 years. Women serve 2 years in the army. But the ultra-Orthodox, known collectively as Haredim, have been exempt. Rabbi Boaz Naki is with a hardline ultra-Orthodox organization called the Jerusalem Faction. He speaks through an interpreter.
My ancestors came from Iran 95 years ago. He came here to study the Bible. That's why he came here.
Naki says Haredi enlistment would lead to secularization, which is worse than death.
אתם באים אליי ואומרים לי, לא, עכשיו יש משהו חדש.
This law, the Bible law, is eternal. So how can you tell me now that the government did this law? It goes up, it goes down. Doesn't matter. The laws of the Bible are eternal.
There are no sources that say that.
Rabbi David Derovin is a retired Orthodox rabbi.
We are the people of the book. If you want to make a claim that is legal or halachic according to Jewish law, you have to back it up with sources.
Derovin says the ultra-Orthodox have been, in essence, breaking Jewish law by not serving. He says the problem is the ultra-Orthodox community is coming from a different perspective on the world. Even though almost a million of them live in the state of Israel,
their headset, their mindset is back in Poland or Czechoslovakia. And they believe that the only thing that they can do to in order to ensure their life on earth, so to speak, is to maintain their ultra-religious lifestyle.
Now, wait a minute, says Rabbi Yehoshua Pfeffer. He's the head of an institute that helps Haredim participate in Israeli society. Pfeffer says there's no biblical claim that any group is exempt from the army.
As a general principle, certainly we need to be in the IDF, fighting alongside our brethren against our bitter enemies.
But, he says, there was good reason for the exemption when Israel was founded, to rebuild Jewish centers of learning decimated by the Holocaust. And, at the time, it was to prevent the secularization of the few hundred ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel. That was then, Pfeffer says, this is now.
The main point is that over the years, the Haredi identity has grown and flourished and become entrenched as a separate identity from the rest of Israel.
That has got to stop, he says, when it comes to joining the army. Pfeffer proposes that Orthodox Jews who prove to be serious about their studies stay in their religious schools, called yeshivas, but the rest should join military units designed for them, which the Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, is willing to do. In fact, he says there are already ultra-Orthodox units made up mostly of yeshiva dropouts, and the army has been hugely accommodating. The Supreme Court decision said if ultra-Orthodox yeshivas don't start sending their students to the army, their state funding will go away. Pfeffer says maybe it's a good thing that yeshivas be privately funded rather than supported by the government.
It will allow the forces of the private market to determine which yeshiva and which boys are those who excel in their Talmudic studies, while others who are not cut out for these institutions of excellence won't have the funding, and then they will go to the IDF.
One big question is how this decision will affect the current government, led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The ultra-Orthodox parties had threatened to pull out of Netanyahu's right-wing coalition if they were forced to join the army. If they left, that would force new elections and likely drive the currently unpopular Netanyahu from office. Or they could stay in the government and work with Netanyahu's party to draft a new law that restores the exemptions. But that would be politically challenging in light of the court's ruling. For The World, I'm Aaron Schachter.
The world's top cricket teams have been battling all month at the T20 Cricket World Cup with matches in the U.S. and the West Indies.
After a strong showing in the first few rounds, both host teams got knocked out of the competition over the weekend. So now just one underdog remains. Afghanistan is going to the semifinals.
From Kabul to Kandahar, they'll all be celebrating.
Fans back home are celebrating. Afghanistan's National Cricket Organization posted videos of crowds taking to the streets in Jalalabad City, Khost, and Paktia province.
This is the best Afghanistan has ever done in the tournament. Cricket is really popular there. In a post-match press conference, team captain Rashid Khan said he hopes this is just the beginning.
It's a massive achievement for us as a team and as a nation. And it's going to be a massive inspiration for the youngster back home in Afghanistan. That Afghanistan team get into the semis for the first time.
Khan and his team face South Africa next. The match is tomorrow at 8:30 p.m. Eastern. The other semifinal is Thursday morning when India plays England.
Just ahead, Australians react to Julian Assange's expected return home next week. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is likely to return a free man to his native Australia very soon. He's appearing in U.S. federal court in the Mariana Islands in the Pacific, where a judge is expected to approve his plea deal with the U.S. Department of Justice. If Assange pleads guilty to a single felony count of conspiring to obtain and disclose classified information, the 5 years he already served in a U.K. prison will count toward his sentence, which probably means no more jail time for Assange. He was indicted for releasing hundreds of thousands of American military documents and diplomatic papers on WikiLeaks in 2010. This plea deal is a culmination of years of lobbying from the Australian government. Supporters in Assange's home country are celebrating. The World's Sarah Birnbaum reports from Sydney.
This video has been on loop on virtually every television news station here. It's a car driving down the road. Presumably Assange is inside. Then there's a clip of Assange filling out a form.
Well, that'll have a number of weeks.
Is that right?
And then you see him boarding a jet. Not very exciting as video goes, but it is the first footage of the WikiLeaks founder in years, and his Aussie supporters are going nuts on TikTok.
Julian Assange is free. Julian Assange is f***ing free. I cannot believe it. There is some justice in this extremely corrupt world. Whoa.
Assange was born and raised in Australia. His stepdad was in the theater, so he moved around a lot as a kid, living in more than 30 towns before the age of 14. Eventually, he ended up in Melbourne, where, incidentally, as a teenager, he hacked into servers belonging to the Australian Telecom Corporation, the Australian National University, and NASA. In Australia, like everywhere else, Assange is a divisive figure. He's been called everything from a freedom fighter to a martyr to a narcissist. But love him or hate him, most Australians believe he should be free, says Mark Kenny, a political scientist at the Australian National University, the same one Assange hacked into.
Australians generally looked at this as an Australian citizen caught up in the legal systems and legal machinations of another country, in this case, two of Australia's closest allies, and just felt that the interests of justice had long been overlooked and that it was time for him to come home.
For years, there's been a push by the Australian government, from the Prime Minister on down, to try to bring Assange back to Australia. Earlier this year, a bipartisan group of Australian MPs traveled to Washington to lobby Congress. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese brought it up with President Biden during a state visit last October. On Tuesday, Albanese told Parliament he welcomed news of the plea deal.
I've been very clear that regardless of the views that people have about Mr. Assange's activities, the case has dragged on for too long. Yeah. There's nothing to be gained by his continued incarceration, and we want him brought home to Australia.
Barnaby Joyce, who was one of the politicians who went to DC to advocate for Assange, spoke to reporters in Canberra on Tuesday, saying for him there was an important principle at stake.
This was an Australian citizen. He was not a citizen of the United States. He was not in the United States when this felony, is what they said, was created. He did not steal the information. That was then Bradley Manning, who is now Chelsea Manning. And if the dissemination of this information is a crime, then every person where I now stand in the Parliament of Australia's fourth estate is on their way to the United States of America, because you all printed it.
Julian Assange is due to appear before a federal judge in the Mariana Islands, which is a U.S. commonwealth close to Australia, on Wednesday morning local time. After that, if the judge approves the plea deal, Assange will fly home to Australia. But that won't be the end of the saga. Assange's wife, Stella Assange, said the couple will soon be seeking a pardon. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum, Sydney.
Efforts to offset some of the effects of climate change get futuristic with geoengineering techniques, trying to alter how Earth's systems operate. One of those techniques, marine cloud brightening, is the focus of new research published in the journal Nature Climate Change. The idea is to get clouds to reflect more sunlight back into space by injecting particles into those clouds. That, in turn, would reduce the size of droplets that make them up. Here's climate scientist Kate Rickey at UC San Diego.
Smaller droplets are more reflective, so they reflect more sunlight and will have a bigger cooling effect. And then once the droplets are smaller, they have a longer lifetime. It takes longer for those droplets to precipitate out of the clouds. And so you extend the cooling effect of the cloud as well.
Rickey co-authored the study that aimed to predict what would happen if we tried intensive cloud brightening in the Northeast Pacific, where marine clouds are plentiful. Researchers ran models of two cases, the first one using present-day climate conditions.
We found that actually the cloud brightening, even though it was concentrated in the Northeast Pacific, had a cooling effect over land basically everywhere. On Earth. And so we were sort of quantifying its effect in terms of the frequency of humans experiencing extreme heat events. And what we found is that the risk associated with these events went down pretty much everywhere.
Which sounds great. The model showed that manipulating clouds in one region cooled the whole Earth. But Rickey says then they ran the numbers again, mimicking warmer climate conditions, which are likely to be the norm a few decades from now. And the story was different.
Instead of the cloud brightening cooling and reducing the risk of extreme heat over all areas of land, now it was actually increasing. The risk of heat events over some areas of the globe pretty substantially.
So when you change the composition of the low-lying marine clouds in one area right now, it would have the impact of cooling. But in the future, it would have an impact of cooling in some areas and then heating up other areas. So there would be winners and losers. Did I get that right?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And so the implications here are that using this technology could be good for some people and very bad for other people, which suggests that, you know, there could be a big risk to implementing this type of technology as a climate solution.
That's exactly right. But I would say the results of our study and what we simulated in the mid-century is pretty definitive in terms of we wouldn't want to do this. So it not only increases risk in some highly populated areas like most of Europe, for example, but it actually doesn't work anymore in our target region of the Western United States either.
You know, the fact that we're even having this conversation is a result of climate action or inaction over the past decade, decade and a half. How have the ways that we're talking about geoengineering changed in that time frame?
Things haven't been going very well in terms of rapid reduction in greenhouse gas emissions or major investments in preparation for the amount of climate change that's going to occur. And so I think a lot of the increased conversation around these approaches is because people are starting to really worry about how disruptive and destructive climate change is going to become over the next decade to decades even.
That's Kate Rickey, a professor of climate sustainability at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography and School of Global Policy and Strategy at UC San Diego. The research she co-authored on manipulating clouds to mitigate climate change is in the journal Nature Climate Change. You're listening to The World.
Termites have a redeeming quality. Hear me out on this. Some termites can sequester carbon, and that could be useful in the fight against climate change.
This hasn't been very often researched. It's sort of a completely new field.
Also, relocating a whole community because of climate change. All that's still ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. There's news coming out of the International Criminal Court today that it has issued arrest warrants for two of Russia's top generals. Former Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu and Military Chief of Staff Valery Gerasimov. They're charged with attacking civilian targets in Ukraine. Russia is not a member of the ICC and doesn't recognize the court's jurisdiction. So we asked Rebecca Hamilton to clarify what this means. She's an assistant professor of law at American University Washington College of Law. Rebecca, let's start here. What have these two senior Russian leaders been accused of?
They've been accused of two counts of war crimes and one count of crime against humanity. All of those charges are in relation to attacks on critical infrastructure in Ukraine that deprived Ukrainian civilians of things like heat and water and electricity over that winter of 22 and 23.
So as we've said, Russia is not a member of the ICC, and it's not just going to hand these guys over. So what is the actual significance of these warrants?
Right. This is not the first set of arrest warrants that the ICC has issued in relation to Russia's actions in Ukraine. I think the overall message is that the prosecution's case is moving forward steadily and that it is willing to go after the most senior of Russian officials. The arrest warrants have been having an impact. So, for example, President Vladimir Putin, who had an arrest warrant issued against him, has not traveled to any of the 124 countries that have joined the ICC.
I see. So I know that Putin has been traveling around Asia, but you're saying he hasn't traveled to any of the countries where an arrest warrant could potentially be executed. Is that right?
Exactly. The countries that have signed up to the court have an obligation to execute ICC arrest warrants. And so Putin has not been traveling to any of those countries.
Earlier this year, the ICC requested arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his defense minister, and three Hamas leaders. They're accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Do today's warrants put Russia, Hamas, and Israel in kind of the same basket here?
So I don't think it's helpful to try to draw equivalency across different situations because they're always so context specific. But I think what the common thread is that we are seeing a prosecutor who is very keen to say the laws of war apply no matter where you are in the world. As long as the court has jurisdiction, then it will continue to bring these cases, even when there is political pushback against them, even when they involve very, very senior people of powerful states.
We have seen, though, so many ICC warrants in the past few years and quite little practical impact. Does a warrant from the ICC pack less of a punch on the world stage than it once might have?
Firstly, you know, the ICC is still a very new institution in the history of war crimes that, you know, happened for centuries. And it's only a really pretty recent development that we've started seeing consistent international level prosecutions and accountability for war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. And it is true that international criminal justice is much slower than domestic justice. But when we have seen perpetrators actually brought to trial, the results have been incredibly meaningful for victims and survivors. And you can think about the former Yugoslav tribunal. Some of those warrants took a decade before the perpetrators were brought to trial, but they got there eventually. And I think it will be the same for the ICC. Some of these warrants, we're not going to see these defendants having a trial anytime soon, but it doesn't mean that they won't come through eventually. And in the meantime, there is the social sanctioning that comes with the warrant, the expressive signal that it sends to the world that these are actions that the law judges.
How is the U.S. position on the ICC changing and evolving?
So we saw a huge shift when the ICC got jurisdiction over the situation in Ukraine and began its investigations there. And I think for the first time in a while, the U.S. Congress began to see how useful it is to have an international criminal court that can uphold the rule of law, in that case, against Russia's aggression. Now, of course, we've seen the opposite reaction in relation to the arrest warrants that have come out stemming from Hamas's attack on October 7 and the subsequent Israeli military campaign in Gaza. So how all that will settle, I think we have, you know, different parts of the US government probably in conflict with each other at the moment over what the position of the ICC is and what its relationship with the US should be. But what I will say is that notwithstanding the ICC's case against the Israeli officials, the US government hasn't moved forward with any kind of knee-jerk reactions like sanctioning the court. So there's been restraint by the US government in terms of its reaction on that score. And I think a recognition that on balance, the world is probably better off and U.S. interests are probably better served by having an international criminal court that can work to uphold international criminal law.
Rebecca Hamilton is an assistant professor of law at American University Washington College of Law. If you are a company that runs afoul of the European Union's antitrust rules, you risk a hefty fine, 10% of your company's global revenue. Microsoft and Apple have both been warned this week that they are on the wrong side of those rules.
First, Microsoft, the European Commission said today it remains concerned that the company is giving its own products an advantage over competitors by bundling the Teams app with other Microsoft Office software. This is a claim that's come up before, and in a statement, Microsoft's president expressed appreciation for the clarity of the EU's message and promised to address the commission's concerns.
Yesterday, it was Apple coming under scrutiny from the commission. It said the company is preventing app makers from pointing users to cheaper options outside of Apple's App Store. EU rules state that developers must be allowed to tell customers about cheaper ways to purchase their apps. Apple said in a statement, "We are confident our plan complies with the law and that the company will continue to work with the commission. And we will have more on Apple tomorrow on the show."
Specifically, the relationship between Apple and the Chinese government. Manufacturing muscle in China is what allowed Apple to become the global force that it is. But reliance on China has its downsides. More on that tomorrow here on The World.
For more than 100 years, the Kuna people of Panama have lived on a group of islands known as the San Blas Archipelago. The small islands are now threatened as sea levels rise. Earlier this month, 300 families were evacuated from one of these islands, and now they are trying to lay down roots in mainland Panama. Manuel Rueda brings us the story.
Kids play volleyball in the village of Isberiala, while adults sway on hammocks in front of their homes as they try to cope with the tropical heat. The cement houses in this new village are small, with just two rooms each. But Jennifer Davis says she's happy to be here. It's safer for my kids, she says. In our previous community, we were surrounded by water, and the sea would flood our streets sometimes. Davis grew up on Cardi Sugdub, a small island in the Caribbean that's just 400 feet wide, but was home to 1,500 people from the Kuna tribe. The roads here are made of dirt, and some of the houses are right next to the water and shared by two or three families. Between the floods and the lack of space, community leaders started looking for a solution. Our leaders got organized, and they asked for relocation, says Albertino Davis, one of the village's elders. We first presented the idea to the government in 2010, and finally it has become reality. Isberiala opened its doors on June 3rd. The village was built by Panama's Ministry of Housing. It has 300 identical homes made of cement with small yards in the front that face wide and straight streets. There's a burial ground, a basketball court, and a park with a beach volleyball area. Johan Herman plays there every afternoon. 15 years ago, we had a basketball court on the island, but it was removed to make way for a school, he says. It was just too crowded there to have both things. Government studies suggest that Panama could lose up to 2% of its territory by 2050 as sea levels along its coastline continue to rise. And officials have already identified 63 coastal communities that will have to be evacuated. Ligia Castor is the climate change director for the Ministry of the Environment. We need to come up with a strategy for people displaced by extreme weather, she says, so that we can get resources from a damage fund that was created at the UN's climate conference last year. Around the world, there are 400 communities that have relocated or are planning to move due to weather hazards, according to the UN's Platform on Disaster Displacement. Experts say there are many issues that Panama and other countries need to take into account as they try to relocate villages affected by extreme weather.
Planning a relocation is about so much more than just rebuilding houses.
Erica Bauer is a researcher on climate displacement for Human Rights Watch.
It's about access to education. It's about access to healthcare. It's about restoring, preserving cultural heritage and tradition. It's about every dimension of a human's needs.
The Kuna placed a special emphasis on keeping their traditions alive as they relocated to the village of Isberiala, which is built on farmland already owned by the tribe. There's a school where children will be taught in the Kuna language, and a large ceremonial house that has a roof made out of thatched palm. Jose Davis is the chief of the village. He explained that the ceremonial house was built by the villagers themselves. Here, we will hold our cultural events just like we did on the island, he says. It is also the place where we welcome visitors. But many issues still need to be sorted out in the new village. Currently, there's no public transport to take villagers to a port where some of them have fishing boats. It's a half-hour walk to get there. A clinic that was supposed to be built next to the village still hasn't been completed. And food is also hard to find because there aren't any stores in the village yet. At the volleyball court, Johan Herman says that he's hoping these issues will be sorted out soon as the Kuna trade life next to the sea for a village that's surrounded by trees. We are a resilient people, he says. We're not just going to sit back to see what happens. For the World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Isberiala, Panama.
If you're under the impression that the world is becoming less peaceful, sadly, you are not wrong. Our next guest has been tracking conflict country by country for nearly two decades with a think tank in Australia that publishes something called the Global Peace Index. The 2024 edition has just come out. Steve Killale, head of the Institute of Economics and Peace, joined us today. He explained how he and his team quantify peacefulness.
Well, the index measures 163 countries. That covers about 99.7% of the world's population. What it does is it uses a definition of peace called the absence of violence or fear of violence. And then it's got 23 indicators, which breaks up into three different domains. So the first is internal safety and security. The second is ongoing conflict, and the third is militarization. Now, it brings those three measures together to create a composite index. What we've got is the most number of conflicts raging now since the end of the Second World War.
So if we go to the rankings, the least peaceful country this year is Yemen, followed by Sudan, South Sudan, Afghanistan, Ukraine. Yemen is certainly making news with those Houthi attacks on international shipping. But why is it at the absolute bottom of your list?
Well, it's one of those countries which has been into conflict for a long, long while. You've got a number of different actors involved in the conflict, such as Iran supporting the Houthis. Then you've got the Western governments supporting the de facto government. You've got a large amount of arms floating around and a lot of violent crime as well. So all these factors add up together to put it at the bottom of the index. And if we look at the bottom of the index, the one thing all of them have in common is they're all stuck in a conflict.
Yeah, all stuck in war. Now, El Salvador had the largest improvement on the index with a big reduction in its homicide rate. But critics say that El Salvador has become a quasi-police state under President Nayib Bukele, even though a lot of people there support his approach. How often does peace, though, come at the cost of civil liberties?
Yes, well, El Salvador is a really interesting case, isn't it? To measure peace, you've got to have a picture from multiple different directions. So if we look at El Salvador, what we find is the homicide rate has dropped dramatically, and then the citizens' perceptions of crime has also improved dramatically as well, and that's what's caused it to rise up. But the issue is you can take 1% of your population and put it in jail like they've done in El Salvador, but the question is at some point they will have to come out of jail.
The report measures the economic impact of conflict, so the cost of war. We've certainly seen the cost in Ukraine, Gaza, Sudan. How has that metric been trending over time?
Yeah, so if we're looking at the economic impact of violence, that's been trending up over the last decade, and that's all on the back of increasing conflict.
And when you say trending up, you're saying it gets more costly to go to war.
It's getting more costly. Yeah, we measure it as the total amount, and obviously that goes up as inflation goes up and the size of the global economy. So it's $19.5 trillion last year. But we also look at it as a percentage of GDP. So if we look at the Ukraine, for example, the cost of conflict there in the first year was 29% of its GDP.
Right.
If we went over and looked at somewhere like Syria, for example, what we can see is in the 10 years from the start of the war in 2011, GDP dropped 87%.
87.
87. So that means the average person, when they used to have a dollar, now has 13 cents to spend.
Even though conflict is really high worldwide, are there lessons to be learned from looking at the country that ranks highest for peacefulness? I mean, what country does top your peacefulness index?
Well, when we look at it, Iceland's ranked the most peaceful country in the world.
Mm.
There's a standard joke that, well, it's so cold, no one goes outside, so how's their crime? But when you look at it, you can see it in the history. The last time they had any sort of war or something in Iceland was about 1000 AD.
I mean, it's really hard to think about reproducing the quality of life that Iceland has around the globe. But do you have any thoughts about how this can be all turned around?
Yes. Well, the same qualities which create peace create a whole lot of other things which we think are important. So when we're looking at positive peace, it's statistically related with higher GDP growth. For example, countries improving in positive peace compared to countries dropping, 2% per annum higher GDP growth rates, better measures on well-being and happiness, better measures on the ecology, and better outcomes on resilience and better outcomes on developmental projects as well.
Steve Killele is head of the Institute of Economics and Peace. He joined us from Geneva. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Termites. In some parts of the world, they're a great source of protein. Here in North America, termites are known to chow through wood, and you want to get rid of them as fast as possible. Now there's news that scientists in South Africa have discovered active termite mounds that have been around for more than 34,000 years. They also learned another thing. These termites do something desperately needed in this age of climate change. They sequester carbon. Michelle Francis is a researcher who's been working with the Department of Soil Science at Stellenbosch University in Stellenbosch, South Africa. She told us that the mounds are in an arid, sparsely populated part of the country, and that she stumbled upon them while trying to answer another question altogether.
So we actually noticed when we were looking at some maps overlaying the salinity of groundwater, how salty it is, and where the most mounds were, the groundwater was the most salty. And it turns out that these mounds have been accumulating salts for over 30,000 years. And when it rains a lot, these salts wash through to the groundwater. And one of the reasons why we actually set out to date the mounds is because we didn't realize they were so old when we started our study. And we knew that the salt couldn't have been entering the groundwater in the current climate because it's actually really, really dry. And so we wanted to date the groundwater and see when that recharge had happened. So that set off the whole dating adventure.
So you also discovered, and I think this may be related to that previous discovery, that these termites are good at sequestering carbon, basically removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which is vital, as we know, for mitigating climate change. How do they do that?
So these termites collect bits of dead wood and plants in this very dry area, and they gather it into their mounds, deep into the center of their mounds. They've sort of got a main nest, and this is where they feed the young termites. And so you have this protection of the organic matter that they bring in. It doesn't last on the surface where bacteria eat it and it immediately, well, not immediately, but after a few years, it returns back to the atmosphere. These are being buried deep into the center of their mounds. And by deep, we mean between 1 and 2 meters, which for soil is pretty deep.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons how we found this out is because when we dated the profiles of the organic matter, we found that it actually got younger as we got deeper. So because they're burying this young material in the mounds, this organic carbon is not available to be released back to the atmosphere. So they're actually sort of creating this carbon storage pump as they bury it very deep into the mounds. What else happens is that when this carbon has been around for very, very long, it builds up this mineral called calcite. This organic carbon gets converted into a mineral form of carbon. And when this mineral form of carbon gets washed down to the groundwater, that is a permanent store of carbon. So these termites are bringing in the carbon and they're working their soil so that these are creating funnels for the water to wash down. And when they bring the salt down, they're also washing this carbon down into the groundwater. And this is being a long-term store of carbon in groundwater.
Yeah, so it's, if I understand correctly, it's about the channels these termites create in the mound and how that then leads to a downward flow of this carbon and essentially the dirt, right?
Yes, that's right. And all this has been happening under our feet, completely unnoticed by us, naturally storing this carbon for us.
So the termite mounds in South Africa, can you see them from a distance?
You actually see them better from a distance than you do when you're standing right in the mound. The best is either with a drone or with Google Earth, or if you're flying over when you have a little bit of perspective. And the best way to distinguish them is if you see that the vegetation grows much better on the mounds, because these mounds have been functioning like compost heaps. If you could imagine creating a compost heap for 30,000 years, that soil is really fertile.
I was going to say it's really rich soil.
Yes, and so the plants grow completely differently on the mound to off the mound. And that is one of the visuals that we use to distinguish the mounds.
Michelle, an idealistic question maybe, but is there something about how the termites store carbon that could be emulated by humans or applied to industry?
We're already looking into that. It's the same chemical reaction as what people are doing with when they do enhanced weathering, where they spread silicate minerals or limestone minerals as mineral calcite onto agricultural land, and then they wait for the rainfall to leach this naturally through the soil. So these termites are actually doing that with their soil workings, because, you know, they're soil engineers. What we can do for our soil, our farms, you need to garden like a termite. We need to increase organic matter in the soil, organic carbon. That's what the termites do by gathering all of their food into the middle of their mounds and their nests. And that is what makes soil fertile. And you'll find in a field, in your own garden, in your vegetable plot, if you could increase organic carbon, organic matter, that lovely brown, rich earth, you'll have more water, better water holding, more air spaces, and of course, more carbon storage. So we'll have better plants and more carbon stored. It's a win-win.
Michelle Francis is an earth scientist. She's affiliated with the Department of Soil Science at Stellenbosch University in South Africa.
15 years ago today, a crowd quickly formed outside the UCLA Medical Center. People were waiting for whatever scraps of news they could get on the condition of a celebrity inside.
At the time, CNN was reporting live on this breaking story.
You see the number of people that have already gathered outside the hospital. If that isn't testament to the star power of Michael Jackson, I don't know what is.
A few hours later, Michael Jackson was dead. The troubling stories that defined him for much of his adult life brought controversy his way, warranted controversy. The staying power of his music, of course, is a different story and not really in dispute. For that legacy, we turn the mic over to this singer and guitarist from Cameroon, now based in Paris, who pays homage to one of Jackson's hits.
This is Irma.
Looking out across the nighttime, the city leaves a sleepless eye.
She goes just by her first name. Irma was born in Douala, Cameroon, spent high school in Paris, and then went on to get a degree in business management.
By that time, though, she was also busy posting videos of her songs on YouTube. She was already inspired by Michael Jackson. One of those early videos was a cover of I Want You Back by the Jackson 5. Here's more of Irma and her version of Human Nature.
Then let me take a bite if they say why. It's human nature. Why? Don't you be that way if they say why? Why? Just tell them that it's human nature. Reaching out to touch a stranger. Electric eyes are everywhere.
Ago today, we said farewell to the king of pop. That was Irma with her cover of Human Nature.
That is going to do it for us on this Tuesday. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We are online at theworld.org, and you can subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss a chance to get the news from around the globe. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.